Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
I want to invite everybody to turn in your Bibles as we go together to the book of John chapter 20. I heard a story of an optimist who was best friends with a pessimist. And the optimist would say something, and the pessimist would always have something to counter it with. And so the optimist would say something like, "Boy, isn't it wonderful that the sun is shining today?" And the pessimist would say, "Well, you know, all this sunlight is really going to scorch all the plants and all the crops and all the farms. It's just going to ruin it all." So then the next day, the optimist would say, "Wow, isn't it wonderful that God has given us rain today?" And the pessimist would say, "Well, you know, all this water is just going to wash it all. It's going to drown all the gardens and there's going to be floods. It's just terrible what's going to happen." So this optimist was thinking to himself, "You know, there's got to be something that I can say that my friend couldn't say anything about." Well, one day they're out on the lake and they're fishing, and they had their dog with them, and the optimist's dog, he jumped up and he ran on top of the water to go retrieve something a little ways away, and came back on top of the water again. And he looked at his pessimist friend and said, "Ha, I bet you can't say anything about that." And the pessimist said, "You know, I bet that dog doesn't even know how to swim." There are people like that, and they will bring a cloud to every sunny day. Whether we call it pessimism or skepticism or uncertainty, the fact is, at some level, most of us deal with doubt. You can't really blame people for doubting either. I mean, with CGI images and Photoshop and fake news and scripted reality TV and paid celebrity endorsements, it's just hard to know what to believe and what not to believe anymore. In fact, it's such a common thing that we struggle with. The state of Missouri has actually embedded that baseline of doubt into their state motto, and they call themselves the Show Me State. And it speaks to that nature of people to just need the evidence before they're going to believe, to have inherent doubt. I've noticed that a lot of people live in the show me state of faith when it comes to their relationship with God. And they'll tell you things like, "You know, I'm just from a family that doesn't believe everything we see." Or, "I've been lied to so many times, I don't trust anybody." Or, "I'm from a generation that just needs to see the evidence. I'm naturally skeptical. I'm not easily fooled. You have to wake up pretty early in the morning to pull the wool over my eyes." Ronald Reagan said one time, "Trust but verify." And that is how a lot of people approach faith. There was a study done by a company called Barna, and they're known for doing studies and statistics on churches and faith in America. Well, Barna revealed that 2/3 of all Christians surveyed said they had doubts about their faith. You know, they also found that more than half of the people who have doubts in their faith stop going to church altogether. So what is it that somebody does the moment a doubt creeps in? In between them having doubt and then leaving the church, what do they do? Well, according to another study, 60% of people will turn to friends and family or their spouse. 27% of people will go to other resources, whether it be the internet or articles or books or something on the topic, maybe a movie that was put out. Did you know only 2 out of every 10 people will turn to their church for help when it comes to doubts about the faith their church is leading them in? Because, according to that study, they don't think the church can help. There aren't any answers, they believe, that the pastors have for them, or they're worried about what people might say and think the moment they express the fact that they have doubts about this. And so, just in case anyone here is thinking it, but they're not willing to say it, I'll be the first. I believe in God and I have doubts. And I don't just say that because it's the title of our message. I say it because it's true. I believe in God and I have doubts and I have questions. And there are things about the Bible and our faith that I just don't understand. I like to say that I went to seminary to get all the answers. You know what I got? I got all the questions, because I have more questions now than I ever did before I went to school. I was talking to somebody just last week, and they looked at me straight-faced, and they said, you know, I've forgotten more than you'll ever know. And I looked back at them, and I said, I believe you're right. This person has forgotten a lot of things to begin with, but probably, yes, they have forgotten more than I'll ever know. I have questions about a lot of stuff. And it's interesting how not having an answer is the seed of doubt. So this morning, I want to talk about how I believe in God, but I have doubts. And I want to look at probably the most famous doubter of all time. He's a man that walked with Jesus. He heard the teachings of Jesus. He saw the miracles of Jesus. He was an apostle of Jesus. And yet this man doubted Jesus. Notice what it says in John chapter 20, beginning in verse 24. Now Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said to him, "We have seen the Lord." So he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and put my finger into the print of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst of them and said, "Peace to you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach your finger here and look at my hands, and reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." One of the things to know about doubt is what doubt does. Doubt isolates people. And what happens is the person starts thinking they're the only one. I'm the only one that thinks this way. I'm the only one that questions these things. I go to my Bible study and everybody's so secure, and I'm the only one that has doubt. And usually what happens after that is this sense of shame and embarrassment, because after all, if everyone else is so convinced and I'm not, there must be something wrong with me. And so rather than talking about their doubts, the person drifts, they disengage, statistically they leave the church. And eventually they stop showing up, because what's the point if you don't believe in it at all? What's the point if you're not as convinced as everyone else? And notice, this is what happened with Thomas. It says in verse 24 that Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. Now, it doesn't tell us why he wasn't there, just that he wasn't with them. Now, maybe he wasn't feeling well. I mean, that could happen. Maybe he went outside to start his car and the tire was flat. You ever had that? Or the battery was dead. That happened to me the other day. We got back from vacation. I went to start my truck and the battery had died. I couldn't go where I was planning to go, and so I wasn't with them when I should have been. Maybe that happened to Thomas. Maybe he just slept in that day. Maybe he stayed up late that night. I have no idea. It doesn't tell us what he was doing, but it does say he wasn't there. Wherever else he was, whatever else was going on, for the first time in 3 years, he wasn't with them. My guess is Thomas had something come up in his schedule, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm going to do this thing instead today because Jesus isn't coming back. I mean, he said he would, but I was there when they crucified him. I watched him get arrested. I helped put the body in the tomb. We sealed it with a stone. Dead people don't just stand up again. So, you know, I don't think he's coming back. What's the point in doing all of this if it's all over anyway?" And so whatever he was doing, he was by himself with his thoughts, with his doubts. And that's what doubt does. It tends to isolate a person, convinces us that we're all alone. And so the first thing to understand about doubt is this: doubt is shared. I want you to know that, friends. We might not think so at the time, but we are not alone. Now, it doesn't tell us here, but in Matthew chapter 28, it says something very interesting. It says that Jesus appeared to the disciples, and when he showed himself to them, they started worshiping, but it gives us a detail. It says, but some doubted. Well, Thomas is the only one mentioned here in the singular, yet in Matthew 28, it mentions it in the plural, which means there must have been others as well. People that didn't want to be named, people that wouldn't vocalize their doubt. Thomas isn't the only one struggling. The fact is, many great people of faith in the Bible struggled with doubt. Peter was on the boat when Jesus said, walk on water, come to me, Peter. And Peter jumped off the boat, walked a few steps, and then what happened? He started sinking like a stone. And Jesus saved him, but what did he ask him? He said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Or what about the time Jesus healed the man's child in Mark chapter 9? And the father came to Jesus and he said, oh, I believe, but Lord, help my unbelief. Or the time that John the Baptist doubted. You know, Jesus said of John the Baptist, which, by the way, was his cousin, no one born of women has been greater than John the Baptizer. Jesus had a very high opinion of John. Well, John got himself arrested for his ministry. He was sitting in Herod's prison. He'd been there a long time. He would eventually be put to death. But then he starts hearing about the miracles of Jesus and the ministry of Jesus. And he sends his disciples to Jesus. And they give a message from John. And the message is this: are you the coming one? Or should we keep looking for another? Now, keep in mind, this is after John had made that profession where he said, he must increase and I must decrease. When John was baptizing people and Jesus showed up and all the people went to Jesus and left John, John said, no, this is how it should be. I'm not even worthy to untie his shoes. He's got to increase. I've got to decrease. But now he's all alone in a jail because of his ministry, because of his faith. He's got no one but his thoughts. And he starts to doubt. And he says, are you actually the one? Or should we look for another? So understand, doubt is shared. In other words, you're not alone. If you have questions, you have things that you're skeptical about, you're not by yourself. Statistically, 6 out of every 10 believers admit that they have doubts as well. And so doubt is shared. One thing to know about doubt. Another thing to know about doubt is sad. And here's what I mean by that. It is the enemy of hope. Notice in verse 25, what does Thomas say? Unless I can see this stuff, unless I can touch this stuff, I will never believe. This is the thing that Thomas has believed in for 3 years. I mean, he's seen it. It's transformed his life. This idea that Jesus is the light of the world, that's God incarnate, come into this world to save sinners. And it's all gone in the blink of an eye because of doubt. Thomas says, if I don't see it and I don't touch it, then I don't care what I've heard. I don't care what I've seen. I don't care what I've been through. Yeah, I was with him, and yeah, I was there, and yeah, I watched him pull Lazarus out of the tomb, and yeah, we watched him walk on water and feed the multitudes and the water into wine, and you know what? All of that doesn't matter anymore. If I can't see this, I'm never gonna believe again. One of the saddest things you will ever see is a believer lose their faith. And maybe there's somebody here who used to believe, used to have more hope, used to have more faith, but then something happened and it was hard and doubt crept in. And you want to believe, you want to go back to how it was before, you want to look at life the way you used to, but you know, now you're skeptical about it all. There's some things you can't explain, or somebody asked you a question that you didn't have the answer to, and you start questioning everything because, you know what, I've got real problems in life, you know? I've got health concerns and money problems, and everywhere we look on TV, there's more problems, and it's getting worse, it seems, and there's global warming, and there's racism, and there's wars, and there's disease, and homes are broken, and drugs are in schools, and babies are killed, and everywhere we look, it seems like life is getting worse. I want to believe in God. I want to believe that he's in control, but there are things about you that you just can't explain. There's things about life that you just can't explain. I want you to know you are not the only one dealing with that. To some degree, every single person's hope is tempered by doubt. And we see that here with Thomas. He says, look, if I don't see, I'm not going to believe. If I can't touch it, I'm not going to believe. And so doubt is shared. Doubt is very sad. Third, doubt is strong. It has a way of interfering with reason and logic and common sense. You know, Thomas has no reason to doubt what the others are saying. It says here in verse 25, they said, look, we've seen the Lord. They're agreeing. In an ancient court of law, this would be enough. I mean, by the mouths of two or three, a matter can be confirmed in Jewish law. So this is certainly enough to meet the burden of proof. And yet Thomas doubts them all. He's got no reason to. They've never lied to him. Certainly they're not going to lie about this. And then there's the fact that Jesus said this is exactly what's going to happen in Matthew 12. He said, the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Well, time is up. Then it tells us in John chapter 2 that Jesus said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up. But he wasn't talking about his body. And then it even goes on to say later that after he was raised, the disciples remembered he'd said this and they believed. And so for some reason, it's not enough for Thomas. Everything he's seen, everything he's heard, the testimony of his best friends, the people who love him more than anything else, the fact that Jesus predicted it would happen and it's happening exactly the way he said it would, none of it even matters. He doubts. That's what doubt does. It overwhelms our reason and our logic and our common sense, and it makes a person assume the worst and expect nothing but disaster. And we say things, you know what? Nothing good's going to come out of this. Or we start to think, you know, I'll never succeed. I'll never get better. I'll never find work. I'll never get married. I'll never have children. We won't get the home. I'm going to lose the job. So-and-so is never going to forgive me. There'll never be enough money. I'm always going to struggle. Whatever it is, it's going to fail. Even if there's no reason to think it will, doubt will convince us of that. It is a strong thing. Thomas says in verse 25, unless I see it, unless I touch it, I will not believe. So now we understand a little bit more about what doubt is, what it does, and how it affects us in life. Here are three things to do about doubt when it shows up. First of all, be honest about your doubt. Notice again in verse 25, Thomas' own words. He says, look, unless I see these things, I'm not going to believe. He doesn't deny his doubts. He admits that they're there. Look, just because you might struggle with uncertainty at times, it doesn't mean God hates you. It doesn't mean he's given up on you. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean you're unspiritual. It doesn't mean you're not somebody that God has chosen. It doesn't mean you're not a good Christian. You know what it means? It means that you are a person and you have a brain and you're using your brain, which I highly recommend everybody use at least part of their brain. That's what it means when you have doubt. You're using the brain that God gave you, and here's why. Somebody once said, if two people agree on everything all of the time, one of them isn't thinking. The fact is, you as a person have the ability to rationalize and reason and logic, and as a person with a brain that hopefully works as some of the time, it's hard to accept anything that doesn't make rational sense. All the bells go off, you know, all the alarms go off, all the tripwires go off. And we say, you know, I'm just not sure about that. I hear what you're saying. I see what I'm seeing, but I just don't believe it. By the way, you should know God designed you that way. Jesus said it this way, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves, so be as wise as a serpent and be as innocent as a dove. In the book of Proverbs, it puts it this way, that the simple believes everything, but the prudent gives thoughts to his steps. Paul told the Corinthian church, don't be children in your thinking, but be mature. And then there's the Bereans in the book of Acts chapter 17, and it tells us that Paul was telling them stuff and preaching to them. And the Bereans said, well, thank you very much. And then what did they do? They searched the scriptures to see if it was so. God designed people to be critical thinkers, to analyze and to ponder and to be slow to accept things that don't seem to line up. And so be honest about the doubts that you have. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means you're a thinking person. Thomas is honest about his doubts. He knows dead people don't come back to life. He knows that rock they put in front of the tomb, that's a heavy boulder. He knows that it's been days. He watched it happen with his own eyes. And so this doesn't add up. And his brain starts to tell him, and his doubt starts to tell him, it isn't true. And so just be honest about your doubts. We all have them. We all ask questions. It's a good thing to ask questions. But second, and this is another thing to do about your doubt, be open to the idea that you might be wrong. There might be something about this thing that's right after all. I mean, after all, I don't know everything. I don't know the answers to every question somebody could come up with. Notice it says here in verse 25, unless I put my finger into the holes, unless I touch it and see it and it's there in front of me, I will not believe. Notice Thomas doesn't say, I won't believe no matter what you tell me. He says, look, I'm open to the fact that I might be wrong. This is what it's going to take to convince me, but I'm open to being proven incorrect. There was a guy that I used to know, and he was agnostic at best. We had a lot of discussions about faith. Nothing I ever said could convince him. And then one day I just asked him the question. We were standing there on his property, and he had a barn there. And I said, well, you know, what if God just raised this barn up off the ground right now and turned it 180 degrees and put it right back down so your door is facing the entire other direction and you saw it happen, would you believe in God then? And he looked at me and he said, you know, I would be more likely, he told me, to believe that some alien had done it with a ray gun than it was God. There's nothing I said at that point was ever going to convince him. And there are people like that. They're closed-minded. They're inflexible. Even if you prove something beyond a shadow of a doubt, they will not believe even then. When Lazarus died, he went to the place of Abraham, and the rich man died and was separated from God for all of eternity. There was a point where the rich man said, you know, this is awful. Just give me a little bit of water to drink. And God said, no, in life, you had the good things. Lazarus was poor. Now he has the good things, and you're poor. You get no water. So the rich man, really realizing just how awful this was, he said, well, at least let me go back and tell everybody that this is real, that don't come here, have faith, trust the Lord, because I don't want them to go through what I'm going through. And God said, no, if they don't believe Moses, that is the law, the written word of God, and the prophets, the ones who speak that into other people's lives, he says, neither will they believe if somebody even came back from the dead. Don't be like that guy. Have your mind open to the things of faith that might be enough to convince you. Thomas didn't say no matter what. He says, unless I see. I have a question for us. What would you need to see in order to completely trust the person of Jesus Christ? And maybe you do now, and you're already there. And to that person, I would say that's wonderful. The only thing I ask is just wait for the rest of us because we're all still coming along. But what would it be? What would it take for us to completely trust 100% unequivocally the person of Jesus Christ? Now, maybe somebody's listening to this and they say, you know, I believe in God, but I have doubts. And so to that person, the question is, how open are you to seeing God work in your life? Because something that I've noticed and observed over my time in ministry is this: the more a person wants to see God, the more they will see God. If you're a person that wants to explain away everything and rationalize life every single turn, then that doesn't leave very much room for God to reveal himself and show himself to you in a way that's actually going to move the needle. And it's not that God isn't behind the scenes. It's not that he's not causing it all to happen. It's just that person is more fixated on the natural processes than they are the supernatural person that put them all into motion to begin with. Here's an example. Do you look at a human being and see a collection of cells? Do you see a biological machine? Do you see organs? And do you see all the microbes that are going on? Or do you look at a person and do you see somebody created in the image of God, bearing his image? Somebody, even the worst of your enemy, that Jesus still went to the cross for. Do you look at the harmony that exists in nature, how the birds and the plants work together? how the sun has exactly what it is, all the green needs. And the green produces as an off-gas oxygen that we need. I mean, do you look at the harmony that exists in nature and think, you know, that's just a long process of natural selection? Or do you see something that's designed to work together? Do you hear about a person being healed and think, oh, you know what? We just live in a wonderful country with great doctors and a lot of money in medicine, great scientists. Or do you think the great physician himself is working through those doctors and through those scientists and through that medicine? That's what I mean when I say the more we want to see God at work, the more we will see God at work. And so how much God do we want to see in our life? Where's the line where we say, then I will believe? And so when it comes to dealing with doubt, be honest. We all have it. Be open to the things of God that might convince you. Third, be observant of all the facts. Notice in verse 27, then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here and look at my hands. And reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. The thing about being open to things that might convince you is you will probably start seeing them if you're willing to look. I love what it says in 1 Kings chapter 19. Elijah is there and he's looking for God to give him an answer. And it says, then he said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. So it was when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? Here's the thing. Sometimes God will show himself in a way that's very dramatic. Sometimes it's the parting of the Red Sea. Sometimes it's somebody rising from the dead. Sometimes it's leading Israel with a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. Sometimes God reveals himself to the world through his son, born of a virgin. Sometimes it's like that, but sometimes it's way more personal than that. Sometimes God reveals himself through the storm, like with Jonah. But often he reveals himself through the calm, like with Elijah, through the subtle things of life, the things that require us to stop and focus, to pay attention. Do you remember after the resurrection, Jesus first appeared to Mary in the garden? Remember that? And he was there, but it tells us that Mary was so upset with everything she'd just seen. She was so preoccupied by the fact that Jesus had been killed, and her faith was absolutely shattered. She looked at Jesus, and she thought he was the gardener. And then she looked closer, and she heard him speak. And it actually tells us in this very chapter, but back in verse 15, Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, sir, you have carried him away. Tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. And Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned to him and said, Rabboni, which is to say teacher. You see, anybody else might not have noticed Jesus in that garden. And truthfully, Mary almost missed it herself. But then when she looked more closely, she saw who he truly was. Notice in our text, Jesus speaks to Thomas. And Jesus is there. He appears in the midst of the 12. The door was shut. He shows up anyway. He says, peace to you. Still, nobody's going, wow, here he is. It isn't until he tells Thomas, Thomas, I want you to come here. What are these in my hands, Thomas? What's this in my side, Thomas? And Thomas says to him, my Lord and my God. You know, none of that is stuff Thomas could have done at a distance. There's a reason Jesus called him close. So be observant of the subtle things that God is doing in your life. Maybe there's a sense of conviction that you've never had before, and for some reason now you've got it. Maybe he's put a call on your life that you weren't planning for, and you're not really sure what to do with it, but there it is. And no matter what you do, it won't stop. Maybe you've had a friend say something to you, and it's what you were praying about, but they had no idea. Could be an opportunity that's presented itself that you didn't expect. Maybe God is saying, hey, come here. I want to show you something. I want you to see this, but you're going to have to get close in order to do it. The point is, God often reveals himself in a way that requires closeness and deliberate attention. And so be observant. And finally, and we'll close with this when it comes to doubt, be obedient. If you're listening for God and you're asking his guidance, be ready to act when it comes. Notice Thomas doesn't say, I'm never going to believe unless I see all of these things and I touch his side and I'm not even going to believe even there. No. What does he say? He says, I will believe if I see those things. And so then Jesus shows up and he says, okay, I want to show you those things. The stuff that was keeping you away, Thomas, I'm just going to remove that right now. Come here, look at the wounds, touch the side. And Thomas does it. He doesn't go, no, that's gross. I don't know you. He doesn't. And because of that, his faith is restored. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Obedience is where the rubber meets the road. That's where what we say turns into action. Without obedience, there's no follow through. Without obedience, it doesn't become personal. Obedience is where we say, you know, I'm going to make my life look like Jesus. When I go to work, I'm going to make it look like if Jesus was doing my job. When I go watch a movie, I'm going to watch the movie that Jesus would watch with me if he was sitting right here. I'm going to listen to music that I wouldn't want to shut off right away if he walked in the room. I'm going to use the internet in a way that Jesus could sit there and monitor. I'm going to manage my money in a way that Jesus would say, you've been good with a few things, more will be given. Well done, good and faithful servant. I'm going to treat my husband or my wife in a way that Jesus would say, that's a great way to be. I'm going to raise my children that way. I'm going to vote that way. I'm going to be in my community that way. I'm going to treat my neighbor that way. I'm going to treat the least of these that way. I'm going to make all of my life look how Jesus would have it look. I'm going to be obedient. You know, in Hebrews, it tells us that Abraham was justified when he believed in God. Well, what is it he believed in God about? Do you remember the story? It was when God said, hey, Abraham, I want you to leave the land of your fathers and go to a land that I'll show you. Now, I think most people would go, but Jesus, I don't know where that is. Lord, I don't know what that's going to look like. Spirit, I'm not convinced of that. No, it says he left and he followed. He obeyed God and he went on faith. Jesus said it this way, blessed are those who hear and keep my commandments. He says, go into the world and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them and teaching them to obey. James said it in his book. He says, faith without works is dead. In other words, be obedient. The point is, until we live out the commands of God intentionally, we cannot expect to see the blessing of God practically, and we will always, therefore, leave room for doubt spiritually. And so be obedient. I believe in God, but I have doubts. That's okay. I will tell you, God loves you in your doubt. And you can love God in spite of your doubt. Then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here. Look at my hands. Reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God.
You've been listening to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Munger, the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. If you'd like to hear this message again, stop by our website at lightthewayradio.org. Not only will you find an archive of Pastor Colin's teachings there to listen to, but there you can find out more about our ministry. Jesus said, you are the light of the world, and we want everything we do and say to revolve around that. If you'd like to get behind what we're doing, please visit lightthewayradio.org. Thank you for listening today, and come back next week as Dr. Colin Munger once again delivers another helpful message from God's Word to help us light the way. In the meantime, remember to be a light to someone this week.